Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Chai with Jams podcast, season two. I'm Ritika Agrawal, your host, where I sit down and have a virtual cup of tea with some of the most inspiring and successful individuals from around the world. Join me as I delve into their stories, explore their triumphs and challenges, and discover the ingredients that help brew them success. This season, we're focusing on individuals that are on the rise, that wear multiple hats, and have insights that can help transform your everyday life. Please join me in welcoming singer, songwriter, and composer, Rianjali. Hello, Rianjali. Welcome to the Chai with Jams podcast, season two. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I am so excited, honestly, to share your story with our audience because I think it's like the perfect example of a lot of the life lessons that we've heard and learned throughout our lives or that keep hearing about. And I think your story is the perfect example about it. So I'm so excited to share your story and your journey.
Thank you. I can't wait to have this conversation.
Before we get started, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. I'm born and raised in New York, in Queens specifically. I currently live in Los Angeles and I've been singing, you know, since I was around 5 or 6 years old. My dad was a pretty popular Bangladeshi folk singer back in his country, but as you know, most of us kind of grow up, we grow up with music and arts in the household, but it's not really something that you pursue outside. I ended up going to LaGuardia High School of Performing Arts, and then I soon went to Stony Brook and did my psych degree. And then I kind of went off and got my clinical psych master's, and like there was no plan in sight of music being a career. But yeah, and random things, I have two cats that I'm so obsessed with. And I very much like I think people a lot of the time think I'm a super extrovert because I've been a performer for a really long time and I'm always doing interviews, press stuff in person, obviously sharing my story with an audience live too. But I am absolutely my most happiest when I'm in my studio with like my cats and my plants.
I think of that as a line. I definitely think you're underselling yourself, but I know we have a good 30 minutes to chat about all the amazing things you've done. So I know you mentioned that, you know, you kind of were inspired by the music at home and your dad was a folk singer, really famous one back from Bangladesh. So I'm going to take it back to when you were 6 years old, when you first expressed interest in music. Can you talk about what that experience was like and how did finally being trained in Indian classical music inspire or affect your upbringing?
Yeah, I honestly, my dad wasn't trying to pressure me into going into music because I have got an older brother who he tried teaching tabla to, and it didn't really work out. And I think my dad just thought, I don't want to have that situation again with my daughter. So if she doesn't have an interest, whatever, I'm going to let it be. But I started to basically sing the Bangla songs that I would hear him sing at home. And just because, you know, he's singing them all the time. And so I picked them up. But I was five and a half and singing these, you know, very typical. I mean, you don't even have to be Bengali to know that Rabindranath Tagore is like such a huge influence in not only Bengali culture, but also just Indian culture in general. So he's got these very famous songs. And it's very uncommon to see like a five-year-old singing these kinds of songs. Mm-hmm. But I was sitting, I think I was in the bathroom and I was just singing it. And my dad heard me one day, but I didn't realize that he heard me. So when he heard me, I got really shy, but he took it as a moment to ask, you know, is this something you're interested in? Because it's not very common. And I guess at that time he understood that I was singing like pretty perfectly in pitch. And that's something that he recognized and thought, okay, well, let me ask her for this reason, because it's not just she's singing a song that I'm singing. She's also singing perfectly in pitch. So it started there, kind of really didn't know what I was doing. And then I started learning Indian classical music. But around 13 years old, I started to really stray towards the stuff that I was surrounded with. So obviously growing up in Queens in the 90s, like Nas was a huge influence on my brother. And so very naturally, like I'm the younger sister, I just do what my brother does. Mm-hmm. So I had influences like in hip hop and classic rock and boy bands. And then we've got like the, you know, sort of punk pop era of like Sum 41 and Blink 182, things like that. And also a lot of R&B, you know, Alicia Keys, Whitney Houston, Boyz II Men. And that's a very, very different world from this traditional Bangla and also traditional Hindustani classical music. So I hid that side from my family. And I didn't really think that it was ever going to be something. So I didn't have a moment where I thought, oh, I'm going to introduce this to my dad, or I'm going to tell him that I love this. It was just that world is that world and this world is this world. So when it comes to the influence, I didn't really realize how much it actually trained my ear. Every single thing is by word of mouth, right? So in Hindustani classical, nowadays we've got students that write stuff down. I was very much that Americanized student that was writing down Saregamapa in English, you know, because obviously I couldn't read or write like Hindi or Bangla. But, you know, at the time I didn't see how much it affected my ear training. I became so great at harmonizing and understanding the kinds of melodies that I was thinking of and putting it down on the harmonium right away from my brain to the keys. You know, there was no disruption there. And when I got into LaGuardia High School of Performing Arts, that's not something I even thought that would happen. But my professors, well, my teachers there just were like, do you have perfect pitch? And I was like, I don't have perfect pitch. But they were like, you're really good at, you know, sight reading and things like that. And I think that absolutely came from how much, I mean, we sat there, my dad used to say, sing sa for 45 minutes. That's like mind numbing for a 9-year old, you know, but that helped me so much when it came to the kinds of work that I do now, which is like really, really melodic. And I have to give credit to Indian classical and Hindustani classical.
That's wonderful and amazing. And I love that, you know, you use the influence around you to kind of traject your journey in music. But again, like going back to the fact that you spoke about, you never saw yourself in this space, but you kept on going back to music, and somewhere you were preparing yourself for something. So in our first episode, where Neha Joy talks about, you know, she discusses about how preparation meets opportunity. How did you kind of continue to practice music? And also shifting gears a little bit here, you didn't pursue music despite going to school for that. You became a domestic violence caseworker. So how did that happen? And then how did you continue to practice while professionally being in a completely different space?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be really honest, post-college, I didn't actually practice anything. And me getting into LaGuardia High School was such a fluke because, well, it wasn't a fluke, but it was a chance that a teacher of mine in, you know, I went to public school and she just kind of noticed that I was interested in music and heard me sing. But because I was such a quiet kid, nobody besides her knew. And so she really trained me, you know, day to day. She would just say, come into my classroom during lunch and we'll practice the national anthem together. That'll be your audition song. I didn't even know what that actual like school was. Meanwhile, it was like a dream for so many people, because as a South Asian kid in Queens, it's, you don't grow up with that knowledge. You know, it's when I went to the auditions, I saw all these kids who had been dreaming about getting into LaGuardia their whole lives. There's a movie about it called Fame. It's such a, you know, I knew what that movie was. I had no idea it was connected to this school. So it was such a privilege to be raised in New York for that reason, that public schools are so available to every kind of person, no matter the race, the class, the, you know, social class that you're in, the financial class that you're in. It didn't really matter. And so I had the same opportunities during high school that other people did. But when I left high school, it wasn't an option to go to like a Berkeley or something like that. You know, nowadays what I love to see, and I mentor so many younger children now, I can't even call them children, but they're like teenagers who have come out of these schools like a Berkeley, and you know, they're fully pursuing music. And that's such a huge change from when I was younger. So the moment high school ended, it was like, okay, cool, you had your fun. And you know, obviously high school was still, it still had all of the same classes that other high schools took. But on top of that, we had these music classes. But when high school was done, I had to, you know, get my shit together and basically decide like, cool, what do you really want to do now? And I got to Stony Brook University. I wanted to go to state school to, you know, save money. And I basically became a psych major because I didn't want to do pre-med, even though I did for like a year. And I was singing in like, you know, clubs and SASA and different fraternity groups and things like that. Obviously at the time, like you don't get paid for those things, you know? And after that, it was over. Like, I had to get into reality. I had to go and get my master's and I got a job. So I was working as initially a caseworker while I was going to school for my master's, and at the same time kind of working my way up to become a case manager. And my plan was to stay at that company until I finished my PhD, and then I would go on to basically practice. So there was no plan with the music. I wish that I had been, you know, burning the candle on both ends. I wish I could tell you that, but truly it stopped almost completely. Like, I had a guitar sitting in my room and I was doing nothing with it. And it absolutely affected me emotionally and mentally. It's something that I can talk about now, but at the time I just pushed it aside. I was living at home. Financial responsibilities were a lot, and I was trying to save up at the same time. Living at home as a 24-year-old is a little hard when you have a life, where you're trying to have a life and you have a job and your parents are, you know, there as well. Yeah. And they have needs and things like that. So it was not possible or not in the realm of reality to even pursue anything at all, whether it, even if it was volunteering my music talents or anything of that sort. And I will tell you that I had no idea what kinds of jobs existed in this space. So it's not like I knew that, hey, I was a songwriter. I did not know I could produce music. I was like, I sing, that's about it. I really underplayed everything, but truly because I didn't know what my capabilities were. So that timing and luck preparation thing, that was something that really came into my life in a way that I don't know that I could have ever prepared for that moment, but I guess I had been preparing all my life, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it kind of, there was a moment, and it was my brother's friend, who's now a friend of mine, who I did a song with, and it was just like a really casual song that ended up on SoundCloud. And a couple of months later, to make the really long story short, we found out that he knew A.R. Rahman, and he showed him the song, and then A.R. Rahman wanted to meet me. And that was just like, not in my wildest dreams. I couldn't have written that into paper, you know?
That story always blows my mind. It's really about preparation meeting opportunity. You just never know who's going to see your work, so keep doing what you're doing. But I do want to kind of talk more about, how did music make a comeback before A.R. Rahman discovered your music? How did you kind of continue to build your portfolio on the side? Because you mentioned you kind of wiped out music from your life. You were focused on a career. You did not know music could be your career like it is right now. So what did you subconsciously keep doing during that time that helped you build that SoundCloud track that eventually took you to A.R. Rahman?
Right before all of that, I basically found out that I had polyps on my vocal cords, which is something that I didn't know for sure. But do you remember when it came out in the news that Adele had polyps on her vocal cords?
Yeah.
She had this major surgery, and I know she took like years off of her career. And I remember reading that and thinking, I wonder what that feels like, because I had been struggling with my voice for years. And I have to add that that's one of the reasons that I actually stopped music, because I barely could sing anymore. The way that you develop polyps on your vocal cords is by a combination of several different things. But the main thing is you're not taking care of your voice. It's something also that people who have jobs where they talk a lot, like a teacher or a public speaker, they can also get something like that. But for me, I can trace it back to a moment in college where I ended up singing at a talent competition while I was very, very sick. And I was like running a fever. And this is also pre-COVID era. So like, we would never do this anymore, because at the time we're like, oh, whatever, I have 100-degree fever, let me jump on stage. But I just really wanted to be part of the talent competition. Oddly enough, I won first place, but at what cost? I don't know, because I sang this really large song and I belted my voice so high, and it must have damaged something in my vocal cords. From that moment on, I remember that night, like, we went to an after party and my voice was really raspy. I just assumed like I was sick, but that raspiness never went away. It lasted and it got worse over the course of years. And by the time I finally got to the doctor, which was a decision I made almost like 3-4 years later, I graduated at like 2021. At 24, I went to the doctor. So I let it just, and thinking back at it now, it sounds crazy, but imagine the mental space that you have to be in to think like, whatever, forget about it, because everything else is weighing in your life, right?
Yeah.
It's like people say, like, I just kind of let go of the most basic needs in my life because I was so busy with X, Y, and Z, right? It was kind of like that. I didn't even think about it. And I don't know, I guess I just let it go. So when I went to the doctor, he finally told me, "You sound like you smoke a pack a day." That's how bad my voice sounded. And I mean, I'm just so grateful because I was covered under insurance at the time and I was able to get the surgery. So 10 days after not being able to speak or eat like solid foods post-surgery, I was finally able to hum. And your ability to hum goes away when you have vocal nodes or polyps. And that just like genuinely brought tears to my eyes because I was like, I've been singing since I was 5 and all of a sudden it stopped and I just took it for granted.
Yeah.
And so I told myself, whatever it takes, I'll start writing music and I'll start just like getting back on my guitar, even if I'm just like living at home and sitting in my bedroom, my childhood bedroom. And so I'd started to write. And because that friend of ours posted on Facebook that he was going to record something and he tagged me in it, my first thought was, I'm just going to say yes, because I told myself I wouldn't take this for granted anymore. Yeah. So that was one of those, like, something in the stars was working without me knowing. That moment, the polyps on my vocal cords, the surgery, me getting this newfound like energy to say yes to these things, and then writing again. So did the song with him, his name is Shiv. And then after I did the song, we posted it, and then I met AR. And when I met him, I ended up singing a song that I had written when I said I was going to start writing again. So those are all those little things working in the background that I didn't realize or know that was happening. And that's kind of how that moment happened, because he did ask me to sing for him in public in front of everybody. And that's what that was like. Well, that's no pressure at all.
I need to stop you there. Mr. The AR Rahman asked you to sing for him in public. Like, we need a moment for that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we first started talking, you know, before we recorded this podcast, it was like I was telling you, sometimes it's so wild to say it out loud because it doesn't feel like it's my story. It feels like something that was written for somebody. Yeah. We had spent the day together when I finally realized he actually wanted to meet, because I thought I was getting punked the entire time, by the way. Like any other normal person might be like, "Hey, Rahman wants to meet me. I'm so excited." I was like, "Yeah, right. You know, sure, absolutely. This is fact." But when I ended up meeting him, we hung out the entire day, and we ended up going. It was in New York, so we were in like the 34th Street area. So we went to all the music stores, like Sam Ash and B&H and Guitar Center. And I think it was at Guitar Center that he finally asked me about like me being a musician. Other than that, for the entire morning to afternoon, we didn't talk about music. So that was the interesting part. We were just talking. But it felt cool because after like an hour, I was like, he's just a normal guy. The nerves went away. It was just like hanging out with another person. Yes. So right as the nerves calmed down, he was like, "Sing something." And I was like, "Oh my God." But it was in Guitar Center, and you know, I was fumbling a lot. I was like, "I need a guitar. I need a capo. I need this. I don't know what key I'm singing in," just like making all these excuses for myself. And then I finally just did it. And I thought, if I were to sing something, I should sing something I recently wrote.
Yeah.
And mind you, no one had ever heard anything I'd written except for that song that I did with Shiv that one time. Other than that, no one's heard my writing. Nothing of mine is released. I did not portray to anyone that like I'm a songwriter. I didn't even call myself a songwriter. So this is truly like a first of first. It's not like I had an album out and I was like singing something I'd released. It was like, well, I just wrote this song and I don't even know if it's any good. And so he took a video of it and then he just said, "Cool." And then we kept going. And I was like, "Thanks for the zero feedback, dude." You know, so it was really nerve-wracking. But it's really endearing because, you know, now I've known him for, about like nine years or so. And now when he tells a story to other people during like a dinner or something, it's really sweet because I thought like this was my big memory. For him, I'm just thinking this is another day.
Yeah.
But the way he tells the story is almost exactly the way I tell the story.
Aww, he's like, that's so sweet.
Really. And I never knew that until like 7 years into our you know, kind of mentorship and relationship. 7 years later, we were having a dinner with a bunch of people and he was like, "Do you know how I met her?" And then he tells his whole story and he goes, "Everyone in Guitar Center just stopped and then they clapped." And I was like, "What?" Because I had never heard him talk about it. So it's really funny because in the moment he was just like, "Cool." But obviously he's thinking things and feeling things that I had no idea about. So
yeah,
that was a movie moment for sure.
It absolutely is. It absolutely, especially with the way you've described, this is the second time you've told me this story. And every time I'm just like, I have chills. Like, this is such a beautiful story. You know, like when they make documentaries on like people, it's like that moment. Like, how did they start? This is that moment. But I really have to give it to you. You know, usually people get very discouraged when they have injuries or when they just go through a really bad time. And I have to give it to you for bouncing back and saying, no, like, you're not going to take this for granted and you're going to work on it and do something about it. Another really important thing that I learned is saying yes to opportunities. A lot of times when people have like visions and dreams of things they want to do, they're always aiming for the most, you know, the most glamorous or the highest level of project. And if it doesn't add any value, if it doesn't have a big name, they usually don't go for it. But I think time and again, we're always reminded just say yes to opportunities, because you never know where that specific one is going to lead you to. And like, you're a prime example of that. That one Facebook post took you to ARMN, which is insane.
You're so right about that. And I think that is something that's key that's missing a lot of these days, because it's something I still follow till today, because I've seen some of my projects that are, I mean, seemingly they didn't go anywhere or no one really looked at it or I didn't get paid anything for it from 7-8 years ago, that's actually culminating in my life right now as we speak. There's projects I'm working on with people from back then who I was a nobody. Yeah. You know, I was completely unknown. I was just starting my career. You would think that these people would have completely forgotten who I was. We're talking like big directors, Oscar-winning people who, like I said, I was just like another, you know, cog in the machine. And I think that I never thought that it would amount to something. But all these years later, what I'm hearing from those same people is like, I remember you, you did X, Y, and Z, and you were so helpful when this happened. You know, at that time, you're just like assisting, you're doing anything and everything, you know, you're not showing them crazy amounts of music you've made. You're not even able to showcase what you're capable of, right? But they remember you as the person you were, the respect that you've shown, or the I guess like the dedication that you had, you know. And I'm coming around and I'm working with them in capacities as a composer and as a producer now. And so, yes, saying yes to certain things, knowing the value that it can add in your life, just for learning purposes, is so important, because you can aim for the Grammy, but there's a whole ton of steps to get there.
Yes, exactly.
And I feel like sometimes when I mentor people, the first question I always, of course, naturally get asked is, well, how do you get to a point like meeting an A.R. Rahman? And I'm just like, I have no idea how to answer that question, because that was, whatever that was a moment in my life that's been written out for me. And I'm not even like a very spiritual, religious, or anything person, but that's not something I could have ever prepared for. And that's not the end all be all either, because I will tell you, and maybe we'll get into this as we speak, it actually doesn't matter. It's great that I met him and it's wonderful that I have that mentorship, but I struggled a lot even after. It did not make my career. It in fact, like, made things sometimes harder, because the expectation was there and the opportunities were not. So I really have to say, I mean, it's taken me all this time to come to a point where I'm seeing some success with it, but just knowing a famous person or being as beside them doesn't mean anything at all, you know? That's something I really, if there's ever like a thing that people ask, that's something I always try to drill into their brains.
Yeah, and that's actually a perfect transition to our next question, where, you know, we're talking about how people look at that Grammy, look at that Oscar, look at that main big glamorous thing. But there's so many layers below that. There's so much struggle behind it, you know, behind your dream becoming a reality. So can you share some of those challenges that you, you know, faced before meeting AR, even after? What were the challenges? What were the struggles? And how did you overcome them?
Absolutely. One of the main things that I had to learn, of course, is the things that you do, don't get too excited about them in the moment, because the industry works so fast. Your projects can get scrapped in a minute. You can be working for 2 years on something and it's not on you. It's up to the production. It's up to whoever is in charge, the people with a whole lot of money who make those decisions. For whatever reasons, projects might not work out. And you're just one tiny, tiny part of that entire system. And for you, it might seem like the end of the world, right? I've worked so hard on this and it's just gone. So you learn not to get attached to certain things. It teaches you a lot of humility and just to be able to continue to work, because you can't get discouraged. It's really hard. I know it's really hard to not get discouraged, but it is truly a test of who is this last person standing? How much stamina and willpower and belief do you have that eventually this will work out? Because it's a numbers game. The more you do it, the more you're giving out yourself a shot, right? Yeah. So that's one thing I very much learned. There were so many things, especially imagine I just got to India. I'd never done this before. I'm getting called by AR to come and work on these projects. One of my first things that I, not even pitched for, he just asked me to record this, was for a Gurinder Chadha film. Now, obviously we all grew up watching like Bend It Like Beckham and stuff like that. So
yeah,
that was huge. I'm sitting in Mumbai and he, not only did he, we lived in Chennai at the time, which was our base, but he has a place in Mumbai that he records at. And he was like, hey, fly in with me. I want you to record something. So in your mind, you're thinking, well, he's flying me out. Obviously, this means like I'm gonna get the song. I'm recording overnight. We're fixing things. He's recording me, which is a big deal, by the way, because not AR doesn't always record you. You get a lot of different engineers or composers to record you. So when he's recording you, I'm thinking, okay, this is a done deal. Months later, like it wasn't my voice, it was somebody else's voice. And it had nothing to do with me, but in that moment, it felt soul crushing because I just thought, like, what did I do wrong? What could I have done better? And you don't really get the feedback. And eventually I just found out like, oh, she just went with a different person because she had someone else in mind already. And it really taught me such a valuable lesson where I was like, there are so many things in the works that's happening before you even get involved. So it's okay. And it's not the end of the world, as hard as that may seem. That's lesson number two. Another thing that happened was when I got back from India, I can't tell you the number of people who thought I was crazy for leaving. And I think I made the best decision for a couple of reasons. I am not born and raised in India. The culture there is so vastly different, right? Not only that, but I'm not actually from South India as well, right? So language barrier was there, but those things didn't really matter to me. I was pretty well supported in the environment that I was in. However, I had to get back to America at some point. That's where my life was, right? I don't have a support system in India. I don't have family there. I've got like two aunts in Delhi, but it's different, right? My family was here, my education, my upbringing. At the time, my relationship was there. Everything was there. So, and I also wanted to make my own career. I didn't want to be underneath somebody for the rest of my life. Yeah. I wanted to be respected by AR Sir as another musician and composer as well. And I knew that would take time, but I wanted him to know like I would always be there. So after about 19 months there, basically, a little short over of 2 years, I came back with the understanding with him that we would continue working on things as he sees fit. And he gave me all his blessings. He had no problem with it. But there were so many people who were like, well, everyone dies to work with him. Why would you leave that? And I just thought, you have to create your own thing. Because now that I've created my own thing, I can't tell you how much respect he has for me now, because he's seen me grow over the last 8-9 years. If I was to always act and treat myself like I'm lesser than, he would maybe always treat me that way too.
Yeah.
But I knew and I understood, well, I didn't know before, but I started to understand my own potential with his blessing. And I always mention him because he gave me this shot. He taught me so much. So without that opportunity, I probably wouldn't have come to this point. So all of my credit goes to things like that. But he's always just like, well, you did the rest of it. And so I remember that too, where I had to come back here and like find my way in the, I guess, for lack of a better word, the American community, right? Mm-hmm. Not just the American white community, but the American Indian community too, the South Asian community. And, you know, I had all these credits coming in. I was on IMDb and I had all these films that I'd worked on. And all of a sudden it was like just white noise. Like nothing was happening because I was in a time where I was like one of two women who were even attempting to be artists in the New York's tri-state area. Now we see so many other people, but no support system, no one to really like do anything. There were just organizations starting to come out, trying to find their own way. So I didn't really know what to do. So I'd reach out to people saying like, hey, I've been a music supervisor for all these films. Could I potentially get a music supervisor gig? And it was just rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection. And I didn't have a job. I was like, should I go back to my old job? I didn't know what to do. I started teaching music privately just to support a little bit of supplemental income in the meantime and see what that would lead me. I fell in love with teaching. I ended up getting a job at a school that involved me teaching students as well. So I had private students and I had the school students, and that really helped me with just income, right? And I say this because I think a lot of people just go all in to your dreams and like do whatever you've got to do and like surf the couches and move to LA. And I'm like, I think that's a 1980s movie, specifically with like blonde white kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is sometimes the most irresponsible advice I've heard. You have to be able to pay your bills. There is nothing wrong with having a job while you do this stuff. In fact, I think it's smart because my husband tells me all the time, he's like, you can't create art when you're worried about where your like rent is going to come from.
Yes, absolutely. If you cannot feed yourself, how are you going to let your creativity flow?
Absolutely. I'm not going to sit here and write songs when I'm like, cool, where's my meal coming from, right?
Yep.
A really, really anxious time. And I was thinking, wow, it really doesn't matter. Everyone, I mean, on the outside, the craziest part is all these like little news outlets that were trying to highlight South Asians at the time that were just coming out would want to do all the interviews with me, you know? So they were like, oh, Rianjali is just, she's like, you know, kind of like a student of his now. And she just came out and did this Netflix documentary and all this kind of stuff. So I was doing all these interviews, smiling and just like talking about my entire experience and just thinking like getting off those calls and thinking like, I have no idea what my next job is. I don't even know what to do anymore. So it was a really tough time. And I kind of, that's when I started to really just like focus on my original music because I thought I have to create what people will see as my branding. And my only branding that I can do, I'd never believed in like the concept of just like only doing social media. You have to supplement it with like real stuff. So I was putting myself on socials, I was doing some covers, but in the background, I was working on my album and I thought, at least I can showcase this. Like, hey, I created this. I sang this. I wrote this. It basically gives you your like resume of sorts. You know? Mm-hmm. And then I started to perform and I started to, I mean, it was a long journey because there was just no money in any of this. Yeah. It was like $150 performance here, a $200 gig here. And then mind you, I'm paying like a guitarist or a piano player or something like that, lugging my stuff around to the city on a bus. Like, but I was happy to do it at the time because it really did open up my network of like an audience. You know, I don't have like a massive audience, but the ones I do, they were all built during that time in person, face to face. And so people got to see me at shows and would give me a follow and be like, oh my God, I saw you perform. Like, I'd love to see you again. And that's how it really started. And then it just started diving more and more into writing for other people. Then of course, ARSR would see that. And ironically enough, that song that I sang for him at Guitar Center, when I released that, I woke up one morning to a friend text me saying, AR just tweeted out your song.
Oh my gosh.
I still have that screenshot somewhere in my laptop.
You have to send it to me.
I will definitely send that to you because I don't ask him to do such things. I'm never going to ask him to be like, hey, can you promote? That's just very inappropriate. Can you promote my music? But he tweeted it and then he sent me an email saying you should win a Grammy. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
My mind was just blown and I was like, it's all going to be okay. It's all going to be worth it. He would always have a way of like sending me an email or a message when I was like down on the ground.
Aww.
And it would just like bring me back up. But yeah, you know, I realized like creating and actually doing is going to be my way out of whatever this little lull was. And that's really how it started. Started writing for other people. I got some opportunities. I got to sing for the NBA. That was a big deal for me because I've been watching basketball my whole life. I got to write for U2. You know, I sang with Shawn Mendes and his band at the Victoria's Secret Fashion Show. There was like all these things that were just starting to kind of come about little by little. And it was lots of ups and downs. But, you know, we finally now after all this time came to a point where now I'm actually a full-time musician.
God, I love this story. And honestly, again, like kudos to you because you just continue to empower. Like, I love that you didn't choose just being associated with Mr. A.R. Rahman. Like, you were like, yes, he's my guardian angel. Yes, he's my mentor. But how can I use this as a stepping stone and make a name for myself and do other things? And I think that in itself is so beautiful and so empowering for so many people, especially brown women. I think we tend to undersell ourselves so much. And we always think, oh, like, are we enough? Did we do the right thing? Did we say the right thing? Should we be carving, like, always like second guessing ourselves? And we shouldn't be doing that. We should be using these opportunities and, you know, making it louder, but in our own way, not letting someone else dictate that for us. So I think you've continued to do that. And it's so beautiful, truly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I've always wondered those same things too. So I know it takes time, but if there's anyone that I can convince with stories like this or interviews like this, you know, I hope that it's, you can take this on yourself and you can do something on your own. You know, it's okay not to have to be associated with somebody or have someone, don't wait for someone to just like pick you up, you know?
Yeah. That's true. So speaking of music and all the collaborations that you've done, you mentioned U2, you mentioned Shawn Mendes and Victoria's Secret. Can you share a memorable experience from all of these collaborations that you've had?
Yeah, the Shawn Mendes experience happened so randomly. It was through an Instagram DM by his music director.
No way.
Yeah. And again, like not something that I thought was real. So when that ended up happening, and it happened over the course of like 3 hours, they literally needed somebody that weekend. And I got like the text or the DM on the Thursday. So I had to have papers signed up by like Friday morning and like at rehearsal by Saturday. And then the show was on Sunday. So it all happened really fast. So I guess that was the pretty memorable moment. The fact that like, it was just me scrolling on Instagram and then a little pop-up came through like, hey, do you sing a cappella? We would really love to have you for the Shawn Mendes. And I was like, what in the world? So there was that. The U2 experience was unreal. Like, so that was an AR involvement. He was writing a song with U2. And I had actually heard of U2 when I was 12 years old through a friend. And, you know, she used to listen to a lot of classic rock and stuff. So I had been singing With or Without You since I was 12 years old. So when I walked into that room, this is actually really funny. I have never said this out loud, but when AR Sir told me that he wants me at the studio for U2, I kept on thinking he was saying YouTube. So I was like, maybe he's doing something with YouTube. I don't know. You just like, don't question things. You just say yes and you go. Yeah. So when I found out the night before, so it's not like I got to the studio and I didn't know, but the night before he said the word, he said the name Bono. And I was like, Bono. And then it clicked. I was like, U2. And then I was like, the night before, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to a studio session with Bono. That's
insane.
So up until then, I was like, are we doing a recording for YouTube? Like, I'm not sure what's going on.
That's so funny. I don't blame you. I don't blame you.
He said it so fast. Anyway, so then I got there and I'm like looking at Bono and Edge sitting there and they were so nice. And he was asking me if I wanted a drink and something to eat and, you know, asking me about me, which was really interesting because I just thought like I was going to be a fly on the wall. I just absorbed everything from that session. I was giving some tips on like some songwriting stuff. I was writing stuff down and then they invited me, we wrote the song together and then they invited me to perform in Mumbai to their tour. So that was probably the biggest audience I've ever performed in front of. I think it was around like 30 to 40,000 people in the Joshua.
Wow. I wish you could see like
I'm so glad that happened because that was 2019 December and then 2020 was pandemic.
Yeah. How was the pandemic like for your career? Like, did you make more music? Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, dude, it was like challenging as it was for everybody, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at it in hindsight, you know, I used to think in my head like, gosh, that was a really tough time for artists, but when you say that out loud it sounds so crazy because that was a tough time for like life, you know. Yeah. People were legitimately dying, people had family members that they lost, and so I'm so fortunate that all of my family is okay. And even though like we all got COVID, my parents included, who are all, you know, they have illnesses, they have things that are predispositions, but everyone is okay. And I'm so thankful for that in hindsight. But in the moment, it really did affect our careers a lot. All performances stopped. So that was the biggest way to get your name out there. So that obviously couldn't do that anymore. But I think this is where having the other 9-to-5-esque thing really helped me because I was still teaching and I was teaching online. My entire school shifted to online classes and that's all I was doing day in and day out from like 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And to be honest, like, I'm so glad that I had that because I feel like I would have lost the motivation if I didn't have something. I think it was really discouraging because there was no end in sight, you know? Yeah. I did a lot of free shows online, but it was hard because it was like, now everyone was going live. There was this pressure to constantly go live and do live concerts online. And obviously none of that is making us money. So it was almost like regressing backwards if I didn't have the teaching and the kids, and I like truly loved those kids, they were incredible. Those parents were truly amazing. If I didn't have that still, and of course I was making money off of that, of course I was able to pay my bills, I think it would have affected me a lot more. But yeah, I actually took that time to think about the shift in my career, because I went from being 29 right before the pandemic, having to go through my like 30th birthday in the middle of the pandemic, to now I'm 33. So that's a huge like couple of years of your life. And that's like a big time where things change, because 30 is that mark that you hit that everyone celebrates. And then you kind of think like, okay, what's next, right? Mm-hmm. Prior to that, there's still this mentality of like, I'm in my 20s, right? And so a lot of us who went through that shift in that time never really got to think about or got to experience what that was supposed to be like. And so immediately I started thinking, well, obviously if something like this happens ever again, I cannot rely on just gigging or, you know, just performing for like 50, 100, 25 bucks, like 150 bucks.
Yeah.
What is the end goal? And because I was fortunate enough to start my career in India with film, I've always loved film and music. And so I kind of thought, well, I'm producing my own stuff. Film composition is something I absolutely love. But again, my own insecurities, I was like, well, I don't know how to do that. But why don't I know how to do that? I've been doing like 75% of it anyways under somebody. I was just so afraid to do it myself. So during the pandemic, I started to practice on random like scenes and videos I would see. And so I just sit there like on the computer when I have the time, and I would just score to things that already exist in TV and film. And once the pandemic kind of started going, I guess, stabilizing a little bit, I started to just send stuff out to directors like of short films and little things. And I got my first job by literally, I created something on my own and I put together some like free footage that was really high quality. And then I sent that over to somebody and he hired me for a short film.
Wow. And
it was like, I feel like I've constantly throughout my career had to start something new over and over again. But every time I did it, I realized like, wow, I can. And so now I'm of this mindset, like nothing is a limitation anymore. It was a cool transition. And now I am, though, of course, I've always started off as a singer, I am fully composing. I just landed my first feature documentary this year. So I'm really excited.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm so excited because it's not a dream that I even thought, you know, you work under somebody, you get credits under somebody, but to see my name solo on like the screen as the composer, I think that's like the dream now, to be able to showcase to other women, especially South Asian women. Like I can count on one hand how many South Asian women I know that are composers. And I will likely see all of them tonight because I'm going to an event for composers tonight. And I'm thinking in my head, I want to recognize how many South Asian people are in that room.
Yeah.
Because it's just, we're seeing more singers, we're seeing more actors, composers. I don't know that many.
Yeah. And that's such a strong thing you said, because it resonates with my passion as well. And it's about how many people are on screen and off screen. It's also about who is making a difference off screen, not just behind the camera, but who is a part of that entire process of making media come to life. And it's true, you can count all of these people on your, even like, I think just on one hand, maybe. Yeah. And that's really sad. And people don't realize how much Western media influences the Eastern part of the world. And how can we bridge the gap between the two? And so it's really, so again, I'm using the same word because it truly is empowering and inspiring for you to be doing this and recognizing that it's okay sometimes to not have an opportunity from someone else, but that doesn't limit you. You need to be able to create your own opportunity. And I think we come in this era and this time where everything can be done by yourself. Like every resource, every tool is available online. Some of these resources are free. And a lot of times just sending a message to somebody can open a couple of doors for you, not just in terms of work, but then also just getting help. So it's really on you. And, you know, for the fact that you were continuing to do that for yourself is super inspiring. So thank you for sharing that.
Of course. Yeah. It's important to be able to recognize the people who are behind the scenes, because they're the ones who kind of make these things happen.
Yes. They're the ones that bring this to life.
Right. They have so much power. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's incredibly powerful to want to be behind the scenes, you know, and also to recognize not everyone belongs on screen or in a front-facing position. Yeah. Not everyone is going to be famous, right? No, there's not like a million Ariana Grandes, but that is okay. We have to be able to accept all of these different kinds of positions. Like, yes, I loved performing, but I also very much love, and different things happen in different phases of your life. I very much love being here. I'm in my own studio. The fact that I have that is amazing. If I get to work on a movie, I get to create it here and then join people for like a live recording. I think that's incredible, you know? Yeah. So yeah, they make these projects come to life.
Absolutely. And speaking of, you know, amplifying other South Asian women, how do you see your work influencing the perception of South Asian musicians in the global industry? And while you're talking about that, can you also share some of the life lessons that you learned from Mr. A.R. Emon, and how do you kind of want to bring those lessons into your work that will influence the world eventually?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as far as what this is going to lead to for the future for South Asian women, it's simply seeing that somebody like me can do this, because I'm very proud of the fact that I don't come from a family of connections. The only connection I've ever had was the AR connection that I got as an opportunity, right? So he's not like a family member of some sort. This all happened because of a chance that I took. So I've never grown up with parents who were tech savvy or business savvy or connection savvy, you know, like they never had people to, my mom was a nurse. My dad was a cook at a, you know, at a Harvard alumni club. So he was a server. My mom, you know, worked in a hospital setting. They don't come from that world. So I'm very proud of the fact that I got here today with none of that. So it should go to show. I think there's a lot of this, like, well, there's so much nepotism in this industry, and there's so many people who have the money and know people. Who cares? Like, literally, who cares? Because there's people who know people who don't have the hard work and dedication that you do. Mm-hmm. So yes, it might be harder. I'm not going to lie and pretend that it's not harder because you don't have the connections. I'm not going to lie and pretend that it took me 9 years to get here, where some people, it took them like a year or two. But I can't compare myself to those people because I wasn't born with that like connection. So what's the point in thinking about that kind of stuff? So I like for my story to be able to show people that this is very much a reality. And when it comes to South Asian women in the music industry, I want them to see the different types of careers there can be, because being an artist by itself is really difficult. And I want them to be able to see so many different things that they're capable of doing while keeping their artistry alive. Mm-hmm. On the note of AR and the lessons that he's kind of taught me over time, he doesn't have a mental boundary. Anything he looks at, he finds inspiration out of. There's so many times that I've held back and he's like, well, why can't you? There was a time that we were shooting something and he asked me to stand in on camera for, like, we do stand-ins and we take like footage beforehand to showcase and things like that. And he's always been like, you have a really cool sense of style. I used to have like purple hair at the time. Now I have like blue hair. So he was like, he's like, you got a very edgy style. So he was like, why don't you hop in on camera as a stand-in? And I was like, there's no way. It was in front of so many people, all of our cast and crew. And, you know, he wanted me to, it was like a very sultry, jazzy kind of song. And he wanted me to like act through it. And I was like, I'm not an actress. I'm a singer. I'm a songwriter. And he pulled me to the side and was like, wait, why not? He's like, first of all, this is not the real movie. But even if it was, why not? What is stopping you from just trying? And I was like, you're so right. Why am I so hesitant? Why am I not just trying? Like, someone is telling me, just go ahead and try. Some people kill for that, right?
Yep.
So those mental boundaries, I've really tried to drop a lot. And that's something that I very much took back from him. Even his process in working, as far as if I can get so detailed as to talk about song structure, when you sing like a pop song or you write a pop song, there's always a structure of verse, pre-chorus, chorus, bridge, etc. He doesn't follow those. I'm sure we can go back into his like 1990s Roja and Bombay type music. You can hear the song structure. It starts here, it goes somewhere else, and then somehow comes back. Most fascinating thing. I would love if someone had a podcast where they just broke down his music, because I can't think that way, or so I thought. But what I had to do was really just let go of my boundaries and stop thinking. When a world is telling you, like record labels are telling you, make songs that can be on TikTok, 2.5 minutes, keep it short, keep it sweet, I'm thinking the opposite.
Yeah.
Let's do whatever the hell we want to do, because yes, you can create some stuff. Don't discount that stuff, because you can definitely create things to build your name and stuff, but also just create what you want to create and it will work out. I think it will work out.
You and if,
yeah. And if nothing, at the end of it, it just kind of shows that you tried. And if it didn't work out, it's fine. So I think that's one thing, like mental boundaries was a big, big thing for me.
Yeah. And also just learn by doing. Trial and error. I think that's such a huge thing. You never know what will work out, but don't just chase an algorithm. Don't just chase the following or the likes or, you know, subscribers. Something that's unique is always going to get you out there.
Yes, absolutely. Because the algorithm also doesn't know what it's doing. It's changing constantly. Absolutely. So you can't keep up with that, you know? But yeah.
But what's next for you now?
Well, I think, you know, I don't even think we touched on this, but I have actually a production company of my own.
Yes.
And basically we've just started a couple of years ago and we have a couple of documentaries that we're doing. So I'm very much getting fully involved in the film space in every capacity, mainly as a producer, but I will always stay a composer and a songwriter first. In the process of having all these films that I've done recently that are coming out in the next like year or so, a lot of the times you work on something for so long, it doesn't come out for like 3 years. Yeah. So there's stuff that I've worked on 3 years ago that's now starting to come out. So I'm excited for those. But in that process, I really did stop releasing my own original music because I was so focused on honing those skills, building those relationships. But what it's allowed me to do is sit with my original music for some time. And so now I'm building a couple of things. I've got this like living room session thing that I had created a couple of years back that I'm bringing back, which is basically a live performance of a song that I've either created or I'm redoing. And we're going to film it in my living room. And I'll send you a link of like one of the previous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I want to collaborate with musicians I love. So I'm bringing that back. We are working, our team specifically is working on our first feature documentary as producers. We are also working on a TV pilot. We're working on two short films. So there's a lot of stuff in the production company that's in the works. But on my own as a composer, I'm working on two features this year. The goal for me now is to continue to do feature films. But my dream, and I hope that I can tell you this soon one day, is sci-fi. I really, really want to be the sole composer of a sci-fi film, kind of bringing it back to, I want the world to be able to see us as South Asian people who can do everything, not just South Asian projects. I'd love to have a movie in my hands, like an Arrival or a Gravity or Interstellar one day. And for someone to like me to look at the credits and go, oh my God, I think that composer might be brown.
Yeah.
And because that's what I do when I watch TV and shows, I literally look at them and I'm like, that was a non-brown show. And there's so many cool brown people that are behind.
Yes, that's what I do. I'm watching the credits and I'm like, what brown person can I recognize?
Yes, exactly. And I want someone to be able to see that when they're 18 or 19 and they have this deep love for music and composition and go, okay, wow, she's a composer. And I just want that to be the reality.
Well, knowing you, I know that you're going to make it happen one way or the other. I know that this is going to happen for you. So yeah, if all the people that are listening, this is the first place you've heard it.
Oh yeah. Hire me for a sci-fi film.
Let's just put it out in the world right now.
Oh my goodness.
And you know, talking about this, like if you could go back in time, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I would just say just to start, just to keep doing something, try not to let all of the expectations of what this could be haunt you or influence you. I wish that I had just involved myself in all of the things music when I was young. I wish I had the curiosity and the courage to ask questions to several different people. I thought everyone was unreachable. Probably stemmed from my own confidence because you don't feel that you're worthy to ask questions to certain people, right? Yeah. Or to reach out to certain folks. Whereas now, if I want to talk to a composer that I really admire, who's done a show that I really love, I just reach out and I just see if they might talk to me. And I'm okay with absorbing all that knowledge. I think when you're young, you have so much privilege that you don't realize, living at home, saving your money, having the support wherever, right? And being young enough to be able to afford to do these things, not being married, right? Not having a relationship, not having responsibilities and bills or children or anything of that sort. Not to say you can't do it with any of that stuff, but when you're young, you can absorb all of that knowledge. I just wish that I had done that more. But I know that my journey is here for a reason. But if there's anyone who's younger who happens to listen to this, I really hope that they just give it a shot without any expectations and just go. Like, you want to pick up a camera, go pick up a camera, you know, go rent one for like $50. Ask your parents, because I think they can probably afford the $50, right? Yeah. I think those are the things that I wish that I had communicated with my family more, how deeply this was a passion of mine. And I think I used to blame them a little bit. And now I think they were just trying to survive as much as they could. Yeah. They probably didn't even understand the capacity of what I wanted, because I didn't understand the capacity. Now my mom will ask me, what movie are you working on? You know, we've come such a long way. So just start, just get going.
Yeah, your story is so relatable in so many ways, because I think a lot of us go through it where we're like, well, our parents want XYZ for us, but I want ABC. And do I really want ABC? Like, can I actually do it? And you're not vocal about it till it's not about it being late, but yeah, you could have used your time wisely previously. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I definitely relate with that. Thank you for sharing again. And this is a question I always ask my guests. What are three ingredients that fill your cup of success?
Wow, that's a great question. Three ingredients that fill my cup of success. I think working with the correct people, and by correct people, I mean people who genuinely believe in what you're doing, because it can get to be tough to work on something that once was a passion with people who don't feel the same way. Mm-hmm. So having the good people around you, always being genuine about that. Number two, I think doing the thing that you say you love to do every single day in some capacity. Not making excuses about, okay, this song sucks. And I'm guilty of this all the time. I'm constantly just like, well, I hate what I just created. I'm going to just go and dig myself into a hole for the next couple of days. Just do it. It's fine. It's not that serious. Keep practicing. I think a lot of people look for shortcuts nowadays. The practice is what got me here to a point where now if I have a pitch that I need to turn around in 24 hours, I can do it. Whereas like 3 years ago, that was difficult for me. Right. But I've done it so much now that it's easy, you know, like I can just turn it around and give myself a shot. And the third one is also to be able to recognize when like it's not filling your cup in the moment and to be able to step away from it. Find the other thing that can also fill your cup creatively, because it's a myth that passions won't burn you out. I think there comes a point where it becomes your career, so it can just as much burn you out as everything else. So learn how to step back. I'm actually kind of feeling that right now. And I was telling you, just went back home to take care of my mom. And when I got back, I was just kind of like, man, I have been only working and then jumping to basically take care of my family. Yeah. And when I got back, I was like, I got to go and like water my plants, like quite literally just to go and take care of the plants that I've like literally let die because I was so busy doing whatever it is. Like, it's not the end of the world. We are privileged to be able to do creative careers like this. Yeah. So treat it like the privilege that it is. Step back when you need to take a vacation, even if it's like a 2-day break driving somewhere, step outside, take walks, like stay up top of your health, because I have absolutely suffered from that. Through several different things like panic attacks and also just not keeping like my diet, you know, proper and things like that. So I think being able to take care of yourself will absolutely fuel the rest of your creative journey as well. And I'll get back to you on that one because I'm actively working on that. So
we're always a work in progress, and I love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for having such a transparent conversation with me. It was beautiful. I feel like I need to do a part two with you because there's still so much more from your story and from your journey that we haven't touched on, like your production company, your past, you know, your parents moving to America and how that affected. I feel like there's so much more. So I definitely need to do a part two. But thank you so much for spending your evening with me, us giving Tribe of Chimes your time, and just spreading so much awareness about music, about amplifying our voices, about amplifying South Asian voices, especially women, and just constantly inspiring. I think your journey is incredible, and I know there's so much more ahead of you. So just thank you. Thank you for spending your time with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. It was like all of the right feelings and words. So you've left me in a really great mood to leave tonight.
Oh, I love that. That's the way I always like it to end. I love it. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to hit the follow button on all your favorite streaming platforms. Go follow us on social media at Chai with Champs and share with your friends and family.
We'll be back every other Monday at 6 p.m. CD.